I am presenting to you today something that is in a rather low key, and it's just the beginning of some reflections on what my paper is called, the queer resemblance. And that is, of course, the queer resemblance between philosophical investigations and aesthetic investigations. Way back in the 60s, before Kemiste Bemerkungen culture value was published, one was rather prone to take a logical philosophical stance in the question of how to interpret Wittgenstein's later philosophy. It was therefore a little more than slightly surprising or startling to find somebody saying, as did Cyril Barrett, that, quote, aesthetics, as he did, as Wittgenstein, conceived it, is the paradigm of philosophy, also as he conceived. That was. At that time, it was not common to talk about Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy at all, not to speak of its relation to aesthetics. The very first book-length treatment of Wittgenstein's philosophy and his way of doing it was given by K.T. Fan in 69. And you may know the book Wittgenstein's Conception of Philosophy in his part. Some 3 years later, Peter Hecker published his Insight and Illusion, where he gave Wittgenstein's ideas concerning the nature of philosophy a rather substantial treatment and was close to making him a transcendental philosopher. Neither of these books, however, even touched upon the possibility of there being an aesthetic dimension to his way of doing philosophy. The only one who came close to touching upon this question in the 60s was, as far as I know, Stanley Cavell. At the end of his famous article, The Availability of Wittgenstein's Later Philosophy, he had a short section called The Style of the Investigations, where he reflects quite sensibly on Wittgenstein's style of writing and tries to explain the very point of it. In the opening lines, he notes that Wittgenstein's style of writing had, quote, achieved both high price and widespread alarm. And he ends with a comparison between Freud and Wittgenstein, where he underlines their common way with the traditional way of exercising their respective professions. There is, however, nothing explicitly said about the aesthetic aspect of Wittgenstein's style of doing philosophy in this section of Cavell's. But in the paper first published in 65, Aesthetic Problems in Modern Philosophy, Cavell does try to spell out in a rather indirect way what sorts of relation there might be between Wittgenstein's way of doing philosophy and aesthetics of the sort. Both Cavell's and Barrett's observations troubled me at the time when I first came across them. But when I first read Vermischte Bemerkungen in 1977, I stumbled upon something more or less that more or less confirmed an idea like that. In Peter Winch's translation, Wittgenstein himself had made the following remark in a notebook from May 1937. Quote, "The queer resemblance between a philosophical investigation, perhaps especially in mathematics, and an aesthetic one." This is simply a ratio. What is bad about the garment? Oh, it should be, etc. And when we in Bergen in the early 80s had got access to the home of Wittgenstein's Nachlass and had started the work that led to the publication of the Bergen electronic edition of Wittgenstein's Nachlass, I discovered that he had in fact repeated this remark with an addition later the same year. The addition is a bit muddled and not easy to make sense of. Well, in English translation it goes like this, and this translation is a kind of collaboration between him and myself. Quote, "Also here it is said, what still does not fit here? And also here the less perceptive person says, everything is already in all. Nor must one in this case throw away the wrong explanation, because it is useful when you want to find the correct one." And so he has an alternative. "It leads a bit on the way towards the right one." And it ends with this sentence. "The resemblance is indeed far reaching." Wittgenstein, in fact, talks of das stumpfe Gefühl instead of the less perceptive person that I translated this. Anyway, we have here two persons talking about some aesthetic matter, and the less perceptive one is satisfied while the other one is not. He is presumably troubled, what Wittgenstein used to call an aesthetic person, or an aesthetic person. We shall know that later. But reading Wittgenstein today, and reading what Wittgenstein at that time jotted down in his notebook in the autumn of 1937, we may be a bit disturbed by his use of explanation here in this quote, for saying everything is in order as it is or already in order is not to give any kind of explanation at all. But this was just a remark in a notebook he would have reworded if he had returned to it. He didn't. Nevertheless, Wittgenstein was no doubt fascinated by the resemblance between philosophical and aesthetic investigations. But strangely enough, we do not find him using the term aesthetic investigations in the 1938 lectures on aesthetic matter. The closest we come to such a use in these lectures is his observation in the third lecture, section 11, which is one of those places where he discusses and rejects the relevance of causal explanations in aesthetics. There he points out that giving explanations in psychology is, among other things, a matter of statistics as to how people react. The section is concluded by the statement that, quote, this is not what one means or what one is driving at by an investigation into aesthetics. And nowhere in his novels is the German expression "aesthetische Untersuchungen" used. Neither is the English translation "aesthetic investigation" to be found. However, we find the term "aesthetic investigation" used at least three times in the one-off lecture of aesthetic matters which he gave in the academic year 1932-33, and once in a lecture on Freud on the nature of a joke, which was given at the end of the same year. Therefore, I will, in the following, concentrate on his 1933 lecture on aesthetics. We have two reports of this lecture, as well as the Freud lecture, one made by George Edward Moore and the other one by Alice Ambrose. At the end of the lecture of aesthetics, he even anticipates the remark concerning the queer resemblance between a philosophical investigation and an aesthetic one, without using the term itself. But let us first take a glance at how he actually used the term, according to the surviving reports of what he said on those occasions. In Ambrose, we find the following occurrences. Quote, and no aesthetic investigation will supply you with a meaning of the word ideal which you did not have before. That's one occurrence. The next is this. In what sense is aesthetic investigation a matter of psychology? The first thing we might say of a beautiful arrangement of colors, a flower, a needle, or a face, is that it gives us pleasure. And the third occurrence is this. In aesthetic investigation, the thing we are not interested in is causal connections, whereas in psychology we are. In Moore, there is a single occurrence of the expression in question, which goes like follows. Well, he said that in aesthetic investigations, the one thing we are not interested in is causal connections, whereas this is the only thing we are interested in psychology. To ask why is this beautiful is not to ask for a causal explanation. That to give a causal explanation in answer to the question, why is the smell of a rose pleasant, would not remove our aesthetic puzzlement. Here we get at least a bit more than just a hint at that one, if not the only task of an aesthetic investigation, is to remove what Wittgenstein here calls aesthetic, Husserl's aesthetic, Husserl meant. Another task seems to be that you might use an aesthetic investigation for in an attempt to find out how we in fact use language in certain types of situations, and get thus a hint about the meaning of the thing. When we turn to the other occurrence of aesthetic investigations in Freud's lecture on the nature of the joke, we discover that the two reports are quite in accordance with each other, except that Ambrose is more complete in her rendering. Moore reports the following. As for Freud, he gave the greater part of two lectures to Freud's investigation of the joke, which he said was an aesthetic investigation. Ambrose, however, lets us know that Wittgenstein in fact indicated a kind of analogy between psychoanalysis and aesthetic investigations. She put the point the following way. Well, another matter which Freud treats psychologically, but whose investigation has the character of an aesthetic one, is the nature of jokes. The question, what is the nature of a joke, is like the question, what is the nature of a lyric poem? And a few lines later. The psychoanalytic way of finding why a person laughs is analogous to an aesthetic investigation. For the correctness of an aesthetic analysis must be agreement of the person to whom the analysis is given. The logical point about the interlocutor's agreement is here nicely and clearly expressed in the comparison with the psychoanalytic explanation. In the 1938 lectures, this very point is repeated in the second lecture, section 39, once more in connection with Freud. There it is expressed in the following way. You have to give the explanation that is accepted. This is the whole point of the explanation. In this quotation, we also find that the expression aesthetic investigation and aesthetic analysis are used more or less interchangeably. But analysis is not the only replacement of investigation in the 1933 election of aesthetic matters. A whole series of terms are in fact used in the same or in a closely related way. At the end of the lecture, where Wittgenstein brings up the similarity between doing philosophy and doing his kind of aesthetics, he, according to Moore, says that, quote, what he, Wittgenstein, had at the back of his mind was the idea that aesthetic discussions were like discussions in a court of law, where you try to clear up the circumstances of the action with which is being tried, hoping that in the end what you say will appeal to the judge. And he said that the same sort of reasons were given, not only in ethics, but also in philosophy. Here he uses the term aesthetic discussion, where he could have used aesthetic investigation. The two terms seem to be more or less identical in meaning in this type of context at least. And fairly early in the 1933 lecture, the terms inquiry and even controversy turn up as possible candidates for replacing investigation. According to Moore's report, Wittgenstein said at that point of the lecture that, quote, in order to discover how we use the word beautiful, we need, he said, to consider, one, what an actual aesthetic controversy or inquiry is like, and two, whether such inquiries are in fact psychological inquiries, though they look so very different. The expression controversy may seem a bit out of place here, but precisely the same phrases in the same order are also reported by Alice Ambrose. So we can be reasonably sure that Wittgenstein in fact expressed himself this way in the lecture. And that might be even in a heated debate, it is possible to make a discovery or two. Wittgenstein probably had in mind some of his own rather heated discussions with his brother Paul about how to play a certain piece of music. There is, however, an interesting difference between the two types of context, which are here exemplified for the use of the expression aesthetic investigation and etc. In the analogy with the law case, we get the impression that two or more persons disagree about the character of an individual work of art, and one of them does his best to convince the other one by arguments that he or she should experience the work differently. And reasons are given in the hope of bringing about that change. In the second case, it is a matter of taking a good look at actual aesthetic inquiries or controversies to find out what they are like and decide what kind of work we are liable to use. The latter may sound like a possible strategy for doing philosophical aesthetics, but it is, I assume, to be understood as a kind of reminder in line with his well-known remark. The work of a philosopher consists in assembling reminders for a particular. But it does not need two persons to make an aesthetic investigation. A person can do that on his or her own. In such cases, Wittgenstein indicates that, quote, the expression of discomfort takes the form of a criticism. I am puzzled by a given painting and ask myself what is wrong with it. This is from the second lecture in 38. So far, we have noted two main purposes of aesthetic investigations: getting rid of aesthetic persons, and two, being reminded of how we actually use aesthetic terms when we talk about aesthetic impressions. This is, however, more related to the investigation part than to the specifically aesthetic part of the question. It is well known that Wittgenstein turned his back on traditional philosophical aesthetics, as this branch of philosophy, in his opinion, consisted of nothing but a bundle of philosophical misunderstandings. He was after something completely different. And if I should attempt the formulation here, I could say that it may perhaps be described, what he was after, as a kind of deepened understanding of the role that art plays in our lives. And this changed attitude, this quite different object for his investigations, is reflected in his use of the known aesthetics and the corresponding aesthetics. It is no overstatement to call this use slightly eccentric. At the end of the 1933 lecture, he makes what at first glance looks like something quite general remarks on the nature of aesthetics. According to Moore's report, he says that, quote, "What aesthetics tries to do is to give reasons, exactly adagio, for having this word rather than that in a particular place in a poem, or having this musical phrase rather than that in a particular place in a piece of music. Reasons," he said, "in aesthetics are of the nature of further descriptions. In it, you can make a person see what Brahms was driving at by showing him lots of different pieces by Brahms, or by comparing him with a contemporary author. All that aesthetics does is to draw our attention to a thing, to place things side by side." He said that if by giving reason of this sort, you make another person see what you see, but it still doesn't appeal to him, that is an end of the discussion. This is, to put it mildly, a far cry from the kind of thing one can reasonably be said to do, or what one is supposed to do when practicing philosophical aesthetics in the ordinary sense. The examples mentioned in the quotable are rather critical or constructive remarks on individual works of art, some of which are even in the making. Thus, it is our traffic with works of art and the immediacy of our response to them, which seems to be of primary importance for Wittgenstein, even if things in nature, like the smell of a rose, the beauty of a face, or the beauty of a landscape, as well as things in our everyday life, like the taste of coffee, the look of a garment, and the fitting of a suit, are also included in this concept of aesthetics. This has, however, next to nothing to do with aesthetics in the traditional philosophical sense. Nevertheless, he used the term aesthetics and the corresponding adjective in this sense most of the time in his lectures, both in 1933 and in 38 lectures. This is also the sense which the word aesthetic has in the expression aesthetic investigation, and its equivalence in those contexts in which we already have seen this kind of investigation at work, placing things side by side. Let me reflect a little on this quotation and make a few observations. The central part of this idea of aesthetics is the giving of reason. And one type of context for giving this kind of reason is being present when the work of art is in the making. Now that's quite unusual, not normally treated in the sense. Then, and only then, you can make suggestions of the sort exemplified. The reasons given here turn out to be of a rather special character. They are said to be of the nature of further descriptions. And the task of describing is performed by producing comparisons and analogies of a sort. These comparisons and analogies are supposed to draw our attention to certain features of the work of art in question. We also get to know the point of giving reasons of this kind. The point is said to be to make the interlocutor to see what we see. The general level of the statements in the quotes, all that aesthetics does, makes it quite reasonable to take the expression see what we see as a metonymical expression for what may happen in our relation to all the arts and not only to visual arts. It includes then how to hear what I hear in a piece of music and to grasp what we grasp in the poem. In the unpublished part of the Nachlass, I have come across one single remark which may throw some light of the sense of aesthetic just sketched. In manuscript 156a from this period, 32-34, Wittgenstein comments upon something he calls an aesthetic instruction, in German, aesthetischer Unterricht, which consists in, quote, showing someone the sketch of a mask and then how he modified it. And just a few lines later, he observes that, quote, the aesthetic criticism of a work of art draws our attention to certain features by comparing the work with others, describing it in terms of comparisons to other processes, etc., etc. It says something like, pay attention to this climax. This is clearly some kind of educational situation in which somebody is taught to respond to individual works of art in a more perceptive way. And when the person has acquired that kind of grasp, he can go on his own. But it is important to note that the aesthetic investigations seems to relate to qualities immanent in works, individual works of art. A reading which is supported by a section in Ambrose's report. Wittgenstein made namely in 1933 some reflections on the question, what is the justification for a feature in a work of art? And a few lines later, the following observation is ascribed to Wittgenstein. What? To tell a person, this is the climax, is like saying, this is the man in the puzzle picture. Our attention is drawn to a certain feature, and from that point forward, we see that feature. This way of looking at our relation to works of art is, of course, related to Wittgenstein's view of art in general. Already in the notebooks in 1914-16, he said that art is a kind of expression. Good art is complete expression. And this way of looking at art, in fact, never seemed to have changed. In Philosophical Grammar, written in 1931-32, he, for instance, states that, quote, what the picture tells me is itself, is what I want to say. That is, its telling me something consists in its own structure, its own form and colors. It tells me something can mean it narrates something. It is a story. And as many of you know, at the end of his life, he made some comments on Tolstoy's rather miserable theoretical reflections on art in the book What is Art? He objects to the view that a work of art conveys a feeling, and he notes that, quote, you may say, the work of art does not seek to convey something else, just itself. It is beyond doubt that art, especially music, meant a lot to Wittgenstein. And in this presentation, I have primarily been occupied with documenting his attempts to get into focus our immediate relationship to individual works of art, where aesthetic investigations may be said to play a rather central role. But what about his conception of philosophical investigations, the other half of the queer resemblance from which I started out? This is, of course, a subject which is generally far known and quite a lot discussed in several contexts. I shall be modest in this respect and end this paper by looking back at how Wittgenstein conceived doing philosophy at the time when he gave the one-off lecture in 1933. At the very end of his long paper called Wittgenstein's Lecture in 1933, George Edward Moore tells us that at this time Wittgenstein was quite proud of his newly developed way of doing philosophy. He insisted that, quote, a new method has been found, unquote. He compared it to a major development in the history of science and said that, quote, there was now in philosophy a kink in the development of human thought comparable to that which occurred when Galileo and his contemporaries invented dynamics. Wittgenstein was very conscious about his new way of doing philosophy and even called it a new subject, according to Moore. In this new object, one developed a skill which was primarily used to investigate such points about language which were liable to lead to conceptual confusion. According to Moore, we were in a muddle of things which we had to try to clear up. We are led to ask questions concerning language and its relation to reality, and our asking them results from, quote, a vague mental uneasiness, unquote. And he also indicated that we might get rid of this uneasiness by doing some sort of synoptic description of language. Moore puts it this way. He also said that he was not trying to teach us any new facts, that he would only tell us trivial things which we already know, but that the difficult thing was to get the synopsis of these trivialities, and that our intellectual discomfort can only be removed by a synopsis of many trivialities. That if we leave out any, we still have the feeling that something is wrong. This is no doubt an early and spelled out version of what he, in investigation, phrases so poignantly and elegantly. Philosophy is the battle against the bewitchments of our intelligence by means. Wittgenstein also compared this new way of doing philosophy with doing scientific investigations and said that in the sciences one is supposed to make new discoveries and establish new facts, whereas in philosophy we know all the facts we need. In this connection, Moore makes a guess at to Wittgenstein's point concerning the similarity between philosophy and aesthetics in Wittgenstein's sense. Then he phrases this guess in the following way. I imagine that it was in this respect of needing a synopsis of trivialities that he thought that philosophy was similar to ethics and aesthetics. Aesthetics and philosophy are both strictly descriptive. In that respect, they can be said to be similar. But insofar as I understand what Moore is saying here, it is the synopsis as a totality which may function as a reminder, whereas in aesthetics it has to be each of the particular descriptions making up the synopsis which has the character of further description. If so, there is also an important difference. The reasons given are thus partly similar and partly dissimilar. But there may be other similarities than the one that Moore indicated. In addition to the remark from May 37 concerning the queer resemblance, it was some talk about being able to spot an aesthetic person. What still does not fit here, it was said, which was not perceivable to the other person present. This seems to be, to me, to correspond fairly well with the vague mental uneasiness which prompts the philosopher to make philosophical investigations. And the skill he or she then practices presupposes and knows for the finer shades of conceptual meaning if the job is to be done properly. The element of perceptiveness is thus common to both. In addition to that, the nature of the questions in philosophy and aesthetics may also be said to have a kind of a similarity. They are, in some sense, not problems. They are persons in their respective fields of investigation. And these persons are brought to evaporate when we manage to produce the right kind of comparison or analogy. And a further and maybe interesting similarity between these two kinds of investigations concern the basis on which they operate. In philosophy, as Wittgenstein conceives it, we know all the facts we need to know, he says. And the same goes for aesthetics. When we read a poem, when we listen to a piece of music, when we look at the picture, we have all the relevant facts in front of us. It is just a matter arranging and rearranging them in order to be able to see them clearly and more adequately. Maybe there are even more similarities, but this is the one that I stumbled upon when I sat down and looked into